With that as an introduction, we'll now ask our we'll ask Mr. Snowblin to come forward and give to us his class entitled "How Big Is God?"
Maybe you could try and get that. Thank you. I must confess that this subject that I have tonight was rooted in my childhood brain. When I was probably 5 years old, I shared a bedroom for the first 10 or 15 years of my life with my big brother, who was a year and a half older than me and smarter, considerably smarter. He had a year and a half of time to get smarter than me, and I never caught up. Our bedtimes were interesting, I guess, because we used to tell each other stories. His stories used to put me to sleep, but mine, I think, kept him up most nights. Because I would ask these big questions, apart from the fact that his name was Philip, and I couldn't articulate that till I was 9 or 10, so I called him Fuff-Up. Made sense to me. "So how big is God, Fuff-Up?" "I don't know, Clydie." "No, but how big is God, Fuff-Up?" "Don't ask silly questions, Clydie." "Where did God come from? What was there before God was there?" "Nothing." "How could there be nothing, Fuff-Up? How could you have nothing? You've got nothing, there's no room for something. If God is eternal and lives forever and the universe is eternal, did it have a beginning? And if so, where and when did it happen? When the universe began, did it just have space and universe at the same time? And if both were there together so that one could go into the other, what was there before that? Prior to that event, there would have been no space. That's what we would discern. If there's no space, there was no place to put a creation in or a universe in to make it happen. Well, from two inquiring, naughty boys, let's expand our minds a little bit. Because for me, I'm sort of starting to come to terms with this big subject. Now, the universe measures between 10 and 20 billion light years across. So if God created the universe, as we believe, it's 20 billion light years across, evidently. Now, a light year, of course, is the distance that light travels in 1 year at 186,000 miles a second. The observable universe contains 100 billion trillion elementary particles. That's a lot of pieces, bits and pieces. There are, we're told, 200 to 400 billion stars in our galaxy alone. And there are 100 billion galaxies in the visible universe. I'm not saying this because I'm an astronomer. I'm not saying it because I'm into astrophysics. I'm saying it because I have Google. God knew precisely and knows precisely where the Earth is in this massive array of stars and planets. He knows every particle and every planet and where it's located. Because God is omniscient, which a five-year-old mind find difficult. He knows everything. He knows everything there is to know. God is omnipresent. He's everywhere that there is to go. He's omnipotent. He's all-powerful. God is eternal. How big is God? My brother could have said, well, as big as the universe. That's how big God is. He created it. Why not? Prophet Isaiah says in verse 40 that we just read, verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their hosts by number, calling them all by name. Every particle, every planet, there's a name for it. He knows where it is by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing, not one is out of place, basically. We could add to that. Yes, God knows all the parts and has names for them all. Now, his prophets knew quite a bit about the heavens 2,700 years ago. Amos the prophet in chapter 5, verse 8, talks about the constellations, the Pleiades and Orion. They had been known and observed for thousands of years before the birth of Christ, seen and identified in the visible universe. Orion was called, I think in antiquity, the hunter. And if you look at the configuration of the stars there, you can see kind of a hunter with a bow. 700 years B.C., Amos talked about it. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 10 said, you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. So not only did God's prophets know about these things, but they also knew that God created them. Oh, I didn't have that up, did I? Well, there it is. Orion, you can see the bow, you can see the hand up, and that's the hunter, Orion. So how big is God? Well, that's just a little tiny piece of the universe, obviously, but there's something very important to me in this constellation. And the question is, how big is Betelgeuse? Now, Betelgeuse was discovered, I think, by a German astronomer a number of years ago. He called it Betelhausen or something. And I might not have that quite right. But Betelgeuse is considered to be the largest star in the visible universe. So how big is Betelgeuse compared to the sun? Because it's always handy to be able to compare these things to kind of decide on how big and how small they are. And certainly when I was 5 years old, I wanted to know how big that was in relation to that. Especially good when you know you have a bigger brother who's bigger than you. So that's something you learn fairly early on. Well, here's some dimensions. Now, Betelgeuse is, if this thing works for me, right here, kind of on the shoulder of the Hunter constellation. Betelgeuse, the diameter of it is 600 million miles. And that's around 700 times the diameter of the sun. So the diameter is how far it is from one side to the other. It's 700 times the diameter of the sun. The radius of Betelgeuse is 600 million miles. Sorry, the radius of Betelgeuse is around 1,000 times the radius of the sun. So if you took Betelgeuse and put it on the center of the earth with the sun lined up with the center of Betelgeuse, it would reach all the way out to the orbit of Jupiter. I'm a horticulturalist, I think of junipers. Jupiter. That's how big Betelgeuse is. It would encompass our entire solar system. One star. It's estimated to have a maximum mass of around 20 to 30 times that of the sun. Its temperature is around 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit, which is only about 60% as hot as the sun. But its luminosity is amazing. That's the energy that it emits. Due to its enormous size, Betelgeuse is around 100,000 times more luminous than the sun. So how big is big? Yes, how big is one constellation, just one constellation in the Milky Way, our galaxy that sits in a little corner of the universe? And that's sort of part of the Milky Way galaxy, with us down around in here somewhere on what's called the Orion Arm of the Milky Way. That's where we are in the Milky Way. That's where we are in the universe. That's where our sun and solar system is, right in there. Just one of 100 billion stars, our sun, in the observable universe. Job chapter 9, verse 9. And Job, the writing of Job is probably, at least most scholars believe, about the time of Abraham or even before. So it's one of the oldest writings in the Bible. And Job says he commands the sun, and it does not shine, does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. Job was absolutely awestruck when he thought of what he could see, which was some of these constellations in relation to the creation and the work of God in the heavens. How big is God? Well, how big is the Milky Way? We've already talked about that a bit, but it's certainly beyond our capacity to fathom it. But we will attempt to give you a bit of information on it. Although the light year is a commonly used unit, astronomers prefer a different unit called the parsec, PC. That's not politically correct. It's the parsec. A unit of distance in astronomy equal to about 3.26 light years. And they define it by the astronomical unit, how it relates to the arc of light, and so on. But when we use the parsec for really large distances, we often put a prefix in front of it like kiloparsecs, KPCs, which are equal to 1,000 parsecs, or megaparsecs equal to 1,000,000 parsecs. Now, the Milky Way is about 1 to the 8th power kiloparsecs, about 100,000 light years, or about 30 kiloparsecs across from one side to the other. 100,000 years for light to pass across it. The sun does not lie near the center. The sun does not lie near the center of the galaxy. It lies about 8 kiloparsecs from the center, as we saw in that other overhead. Now, this really is so far beyond any of our imagination. It's simply mind-blowing. It's mind-numbing, as a matter of fact. It blows your mind, and as a matter of fact, this actually blew Abraham's mind. Abraham was having a chat with God about a covenant that God was renewing with Abraham. It had to do with possession of land and the birth of a son. And Abraham was going, yeah, right, okay. And so God says, Abraham, go outside. Look up at the stars. It's a good way to call him out, right? Look up at the stars and count them. You're so smart. Give me a number. If you're able to give me a number. Of course, Abraham said, okay, you win, basically, and went back inside. Because there was no way that he could possibly conceive of how many stars are there, even in his own narrow focus of his visible universe. This is actually shock and awe, and it's good for us to have shock and awe once in a while. And that chapter that Chase read tonight from Isaiah 40 is a shock and awe chapter, and God willing, we'll come back to that in a few moments. So it's huge. It's mind-numbing. Abraham just said, I can't, and he went back inside. But there's more, actually. A new universe map unveils 300,000 new galaxies. A map of the night sky charting hundreds of thousands of previously unknown galaxies has been revealed. It was taken during a telescope, using a telescope that can detect faint light sources most optical instruments are unable to see. So if you have to ask the question, how big is God, as big as the universe, well, maybe we've only just begun to understand what God is and how large he is. But again, when we're thinking about size, we have to have some comparative shapes or some comparative numbers, because big is only big in relation to something that's small, and something that's small is only small because of something that's big. So my brother was always bigger than me, and I was always smaller than him. So you can understand that. So when we think about how big is God, we need to probably ask ourselves a few questions. And that is, how big are we? Well, here are two pictures. One's a picture and the other is an artist's conception. One of a brain cell and the other of the universe. Now, they're oddly similar, I suggest. The more you look at it, you look at it thinking, well, maybe I'm looking at the same thing here, a brain cell and a picture of the universe. Well, again, the question, how big is God? We have to also ask the question, not only how small are we, but how small is God? And here's an artist's conception of a human cell. In a new study posted ahead of publication on BioX website, three scientists led by the Wiseman Institute, Wiseman Institute of Science, including Dr. Ron Milo, find that the average human male is made up of 30 trillion cells. The average human male is made up of 30 trillion cells, and apart from the cells, also contains about 40 trillion bacteria, most of which, of course, reside in the digestive tract. And this is a cell here, an artist's conception of a cell. 30 trillion cells, they suggest. And the National Geographic has backed that up, confirming that they think that there's 37.2 million, but I wouldn't argue about, you know, a few trillion cells. There's clearly a number that's hard to comprehend. National Geographic says that there are 200 different types of cells in the human body. Within these cells, there are about 20 different types of structures or organelles. And organelles are just these organs within the cell. And each organelle performs a different function, including something that fascinates me. Oops. This thing doesn't, but here is this little tail that comes out of the cell called your flagellum. I know that's probably me and my eyesight that sees that a little bit blurry, but it's like a little tail, and what it's there for flipping the cell around when it wants to move. And there's something else I'd like to say about that in a moment. There are about 20 different components of the average cell. Now, each cell contains specialized energy. They're actually factories called biofires that use adenosine triphosphate, which is referred to as ATP. Each cell contains hundreds of these miniature ATP motors embedded in the surface of the mitochondria. We won't get into that particularly, but these little cells have motors like this little thing with a flagellum on it that actually flip and turn. But here's the point. Each motor, each one of these, is considered to be 200,000 times smaller than a pinhead. Now, that's mind-bogglingly small. You can see a pinhead. When you think of 200,000 times smaller than a pinhead, and at the center of the ATP is a tiny wheel that turns at about 100 revolutions per second and produces 3 ATP molecules per rotation. So that's where we get our energy from. The mitochondria is the structure in the cytoplasm of all cells except bacteria that doesn't have it, in which food molecules, including sugar, fatty acids, and amino acids, are broken down in the presence of oxygen and converted to energy in the form of ATP. So that's what's going on in the cell. Now, before I went to school in 1950 maybe, and before, it was thought that the element was the smallest part of matter. Elements were the smallest part of matter. 100 years ago or more, elements were the smallest part of matter. By the time I got to school, that went by the board, and it was the atom which was the smallest part of matter. However, they then found out that this actually wasn't the smallest part of matter, because inside the atom were three basic parts, the neutrons, the electrons, and the nucleus, that were in their own orbit around each other, around the nucleus in the center. The protons and neutrons are made of even smaller subatomic particles. Elements are made of atoms, which are particles that represent the most basic form of life or of an element. An atom is the smallest particle of an element and cannot be further divided, they thought, until finally they broke one or split one. They were called atoms because it's a Greek word that says indivisible. They thought, this is it. You can't go any farther than that. We need to also understand that these atoms, these particles within the atoms, are surrounded and separated by massive amounts of space in relation to their orbits. There's huge space between them. And then they found that there are smaller things that make up pieces of the atom. I think they call them quarks or something or whatever. So what we have is organizational units of life. Each level is miraculous in its own right. So to the left-hand side of this lower line of text, where you have subatomic particles, you can go farther left. So again, when we first discovered the subatomic particles of the proton, neutron, and electron, we thought we had identified the fundamental building blocks of life. Surely nothing could be smaller. But scientists sometimes have a way of being premature with their pronouncements. And since then, we have identified over 200 subatomic particles smaller than the initial proton, neutron, and electron. And they're still digging deeper and deeper and still uncovering even smaller particles. Some physicists are beginning to believe that we are infinite. There's no end to how small it gets. But each part, of course, is dependent on the others and can't function or exist without the other parts. Now, to me, as I get older and take these things into my conscious thought, this speaks to me of creation. There's no other possible answer to this. All of these particles must be there because of a designer, a purpose to make it work, to come together. It speaks to us of God, which holds all of this in the palm of his hand, is that reading that we had this evening from Isaiah chapter 40. Now, if you'll forgive me, I'll bring you some lunacy from author Douglas Adams, from his bestseller, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He says the specific dimensional measurements of our human existence have no cosmic transcendence or eternal significance. The specific dimensional measurements of our human existence have no cosmic transcendence or eternal significance. And what is provocative about it is our entire universe might actually be but a tiny subatomic system within a molecule of God's throne. Woo, that's small. Psalm chapter 8, the psalmist says, "When I look to your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him?" Now, this comment by Adams is not particularly as blasphemous as we might think. Thus says the Lord, the heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. So here's some sense of perspective here. What is the house that you would build for me, and what is the place of my rest? All these things my hand has made. And so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. That's why it's there, because there is a creator, because God created it to be this way. God is infinite. Not only is God infinite, but he's huge, as big as the universe, and infinite as small as the smallest, tiniest quark of our nature, of our body, of our makeup and being. Now here's a quote from Dr. Richard Swenson from his book, More Than Meets the Eye. When God created a human-oriented universe, he apparently showed a preference for dimensional symmetry and probably math as well. Dimensional symmetry. In other words, how do big things relate to little things? And where is man to be able to decide how big is God? So what he suggests is that if we took a human being and just put a number 10, a value of a 10 to a human being, we took the largest created entity, which is, of course, the universe, the entire universe, and you related the entire universe to the base number of man, you would multiply the human number 10 to the 27th power. Now, that doesn't seem a lot, but when you start to go to the 27th power, it gets huge and huge and bigger and huge. And so from a point of view of a human being, at, say, the value of 10 in size, the universe would be 10 to the power of 27. Now, the smallest subatomic particle would be 10 to the minus 26th power. Now, there is a dimensional symmetry to that. We thought about how small the smallest parts of our bodies are and the size of the universe. It works out about like that. We fall in the middle. Human beings mathematically fall in the middle. Now, all design in our earthly existence is set to the human dimension. God's world that he created was set to the human dimension. The heavens, he said, are the Lord's heavens, but the earth he has given to the children of men. And when he did that, he set up the dimensions of the world that we live in according to the human dimension, as Dr. Swenson is sort of indicating here. But it's true with everything. These doors that you walk through are 6'8" high. They don't have to be higher because most people aren't that tall. 200 or 300 years ago in Europe and Britain, people were 4'8", so they had lower door frames. So our doors and our windows and our rooms, the size of our rooms, our sidewalks, our fences, our roads, our automobiles, all designed to the human scale. I happen to have a credential in landscape design. Good landscape design is according to the human scale. For instance, in laying out plants, you say, how high is the plant? How big is it going to grow? Ankle high, knee high, waist high, shoulder high, head high. It's a human scale. What this means is, when we think of how big God is, that he created a human-oriented, human-centered universe. Again, the heavens are the Lord's heavens, but the earth he has given to the children of men. For you form my inward parts, and this is part of the hymn that we sang to open tonight. You form my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows very well. This, friends, is a soul-satisfying universe, designed to the dimension of human beings, to you and I, the purpose of which is to offer praise to the Creator. Isaiah 57, verse 15, "For thus saith the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in a high and holy place, but also with him who has a contrite and humble spirit." To revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. The eternal Creator, who's laid all of this out, to the largest possible creation, the universe itself, to the smallest particle of matter within our own bodies, this eternal Creator is interested in hearts in which he can dwell. That, I think, is the most important thing for us to get hold of. Solomon in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 9 says, "He has made everything beautiful in its time, but he has also put eternity in our hearts." He's created everything beautiful in its time, but he has put eternity in our hearts. God is interested in our hearts. And this Isaiah chapter 40, verse 12, we'll just have a look at a couple of pieces of it, is again the shock and awe where the prophets of God come along and say, "Hey, look at this. You know, this is bigger than you. God is bigger than you. And he wants you to understand that. He wants you to see how he sees things in relation to the world and against you and your enemies, and who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span." We can't do that. Abraham couldn't do that. "And calculated the dust of the earth in measure." God said to Abraham, "Your seed is going to be like the sand on the seashore." He couldn't count it. It was beyond measure. "Weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in the balance. Who has directed the spirit of the Lord? Or who is his counselor? Who his counselor has taught God? With whom did he take counsel? And who instructed him? Who taught him the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge? Who showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are a drop in the bucket. They are counted as small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing, Lebanon not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are nothing. They are counted by him as less than nothing and worthless." In this relationship between the eternal Creator of the earth and mankind that he has placed on it, there is this reality, the shock and awe of us understanding where we are in all of it and how big God really is. And since the beginning of creation, mankind has done a rather poor job of acknowledging their Creator, as the prophet Isaiah is trying to direct people to do. Done a rather poor job of acknowledging their Creator and the wonders of his power and his creative power. And mankind had a really big problem in understanding the ways of the Creator and responding with praise and awe. And I suggest to you that mankind still does. And God says, "Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Humble yourself before the Lord, and he will exalt you." How big is God? How big is his mercy? He says to the failing mankind that he created, "Come to me. Come to me and humble yourself, and I will exalt you." That's how big God is. Moses is trying to explain this to his people as they came out of the wilderness. "For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? Whenever we call upon him," Moses says to the people of Israel, "this is the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of Moses, God of the nation of Israel." This God, this exalted Creator of the heavens and the earth, is near you. No other nation has a God like that. And when you call on him, if you need him, he will draw near to you. Back to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. The everlasting, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent God. He wants to energize us with his creative power. As he goes on to say, even the youths will faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not be weary. They will walk and not faint. And back to that hymn that we opened with, Psalm 139, verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart, and try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way of everlasting. How big is God? The God, the everlasting creator. He knows everything from the beginning of time. He knows your thoughts and my thoughts. Right now, everyone in this room, he knows them, the thoughts of our hearts. Since the moment of your birth until the day you die, every one of us at the same time, God knows, not only us, but everyone else on the face of this earth that has ever existed. All at once, knows it all, processes it all. What a blessing to know that God loves us so much that he is prepared to search our hearts, take the time to search our hearts so that he can lead us in his way everlasting. So one of the last questions has to be, how big is your heart? Paul says in the New Testament, writing to the church in Corinth, he says, for we are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. How big is God has to be answered with the question, how big is your heart? God has promised that he will fit into it, dwell in it, and live in it. Are you prepared to open your heart to God? Yes, how big is your heart? Can we make room for this Creator God to abide in us? Do you have the room? This is the one to whom I will look, he says. He who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. That's the type of heart we need to have for God to occupy it. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their trouble. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. You have a humble heart, a crushed spirit. That is what God is looking for. Come to the eternal creator. Give your life to him. And part of that psalm that we sang opening tonight, his heart searching and rending in itself. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down. You are acquainted with all my ways. Acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord. Behold, you know it altogether. Even before my next statement, God knows what I'm going to say. You hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. God is so big, I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? This means, friends, that you can run, but you can't hide. God knows everything. He knows the thoughts of every heart, as I've said, in this room tonight, all at once. God knows every thought and action of your life from this day forward until you die. God knows every prayer of your heart before you contemplate it. God knows this and God loves you. And all of this, creation and life, is because God loves you, because he created a world for you. It is exactly perfect for you. In the middle of the greatest universe to the smallest minute particle, God loves you. Don't flee. Don't flee from his presence. Don't even try. Stop and let God into your heart.